From Battle to Victory, Commentary for the March 14, 2020 Sabbath School Lesson by Stephen Terry, Director, Stillwaters Ministry, www.visitstillwaters.com. I looked up, and there before me was a man dressed in linen, with a belt of fine gold from Uphaz around his waist. His body was like topaz, his face like lightning, his eyes like flaming torches, his arms and legs like the gleam of burnished bronze, and his voice like the sound of a multitude. Daniel chapter 10, verses 5 through 6. In chapter 10, Daniel encounters a man, apparently in vision, with decidedly unusual appearance. Similarities seem apparent between this individual and Christ in Revelation chapter 1, even down to the gold belt or sash both individuals were wearing. The bright light of the face, the fiery eyes, and the similarity of the voices adds further to the temptation to identify this individual as Christ. Some have said it cannot be Christ because the prince of Persia withstood him, and no one can withstand Christ. But is this a valid argument? After all, do not sinners resist him every day? And doesn't Satan resist him to every extent possible? Of course, they do not ultimately prevail, but this does not stop them from resisting. Some who equate the Archangel Michael with Christ might have this reason for objecting to identifying the unnamed man in this chapter with Christ, because the man before Daniel reveals that he is not Michael, but Michael is helping him. Interestingly, although Daniel mentions Michael in recounting this incident and has previously interacted with Gabriel, he does not even hint at recognition of this individual, which perhaps should give us pause in our speculations. Sometimes it seems there are those among us who purport to have everything regarding heaven and those who dwell there figured out to minute detail. A beast, a statue, a scroll, all have no mystery for them. They know exactly what each means and will string together a mountain of proof texts suspended in an interpretive framework of human devising to tie it all together, printed on charts and presented in slides and various other multimedia offerings. It is all very impressive until one realizes that if even one tiny link in the chain falls under suspicion as to its veracity in any way, the entire edifice may collapse. This may be why denominations so vehemently defend their prophetic constructs, because they realize that also. Whenever these things are presented as a matter of faith rather than fact, perhaps we should listen if our senses begin to tell us otherwise. Many Christians have died through the centuries who were killed by fellow Christians over just such matters of suspicious but mandated dogma. How many have lost their lives over the doctrine of transubstantiation? How many over predestination? How many over baptism by immersion? In view of the light of Christ's incarnate ministry, these quibbles seem unessential when compared to the parables of Jesus. According to the parable of the sheep and the goats, salvation is available to those who don't even perceive Christ's presence in their lives. Maybe the belief that we have to have everything perfectly understood to be saved is an assumption on our part. When I see people with Down syndrome, or I see young people still trying to figure out this world and how to live in it, I cannot help but see the problems with such an assumption. If we look at the book of Daniel, we see an attempt in Daniel 8 to harmonize the Hebrew portion that begins there with the earlier Aramaic chiasm that ended in chapter 7. An attempt that falls somewhat short, but that attempt was not so much to provide understanding of that portion of Daniel as it was to provide a transition to the real focus of the Hebrew segment. That focus is encapsulated in chapters 10 through 12, with the warfare of chapter 11 being central to that message. The text argues for these chapters having been written at or near the time of the Maccabees, when the rulers and empires mentioned had come and gone, and the only real enemies were the Seleucids to the north and the ancient, sometimes foe, sometimes friend, Egypt, ruled by the Ptolemies to the south. Both empires arose after Alexander the Great's untimely death. If we accept that this segment of the book was to provide justification for the Maccabean revolt, with an implied endorsement of someone of unquestionable religious devotion and faith in the person of Daniel, it is possible to see that the identity of the man in chapter 10 is irrelevant beyond implying a heavenly endorsement of the revolt by prophesying what was taking place under the Maccabees. The story of the Maccabean revolt is not contained in Protestant Bibles. Perhaps it should be, to help understand the intertestamental period and why things were as they were for Christ's incarnation. For those who are curious, they can be found in most Catholic Bibles as the Apocrypha, a word that can be translated as hidden or obscure writings. Seventh-day Adventists and other Seventh-day denominations would possibly find the writings troublesome. When faced with a lost battle and lost lives for refusing to fight on the Sabbath, the Maccabees determined that waging war on the Sabbath was allowed, and they began to achieve victories. You can read about this in 1 Maccabees chapter 2, verses 29 through 41. However, far from being an endorsement of general Sabbath breaking, it was seen as recognition of the importance of defending those who kept Sabbath, even if it meant warfare on Sabbath to do so. Perhaps this policy is why the modern state of Israel survives, for enemies of the Jews have long used the advent of Jewish holy days as an opportunity to try to launch surprise attacks against them, such as the Yom Kippur War of 1973. They have learned by experience that they will not incur God's wrath for defending themselves on Sabbath or other holy days. If we focus on trying to develop a detailed understanding of the identity of the man in the linen robe, we may stand in danger of missing that this chapter is merely a transition to chapter 11, and replace the importance of that chapter by elevating the introduction over the body of this section. Of course, the temptation to do this might be very great, because we can see parallels like those between the individual here and Christ in Revelation chapter 1. While the symbolism in chapter 11 is often seen as vague and obscure, attempts at deciphering Daniel have often made that abundantly clear with detailed interpretations of Daniel for chapters 10 and 12, but glossed over opinions being offered for chapter 11. This may be because while the vagueness of the symbology allows a wide latitude for interpretation, it also prevents a substantive challenge to interpretations that may appear specious, driven only by a denomination's own apocalyptic perspective. In other words, the parties involved in chapter 11 have enough malleability in them to be shaped to whatever conflict one sees as relevant. Depending on when one lives and who is fighting, any conflict becomes apocalyptic fodder for proclamation of the end times. This may also reveal the likelihood that this portion of Daniel was written as spiritual justification for the Maccabees, for it is remarkably suitable to justify most other conflicts as apocalyptically essential as well, especially those waged from a religious or moral foundation. All that being said, perhaps we can let the man in chapter 10 simply be a heavenly being as the writer of the chapter envisioned how one should look. The identity was not as important as the idea of a heavenly endorsement. A little name-dropping, as in the mention of Michael, could have been just some extra frosting on the cake. This being knows Michael, and since Michael is the archangel, it lends power to this being's statements as arguments from implied authority and not simply his own ideas. At a time when the Jewish faith was under assault, and that faith could be a unifying force to resist invasion by the Seleucids, an appeal to a heavenly authority could be the difference between a successful revolt and disorganized uprisings destined to fall apart when seriously challenged. For this, among other reasons, the revolt did not fail. One of its successes is why the Jews celebrate Hanukkah today. It also set in motion the events that would set Herod the Great on the throne in Jerusalem, and that would bring Roman occupation of Palestine. These events were crucial to the course of Jesus' life, even though the idea of an imminent messianic incarnation may have been far from the mind of the writer. But then who is to say where the line between inspired prophecy and historical prose should be drawn? Does the inspiration exist in the writer, or does it instead exist in later interpretations that may have nothing to do with the writer's intent? Perhaps that is a question of faith only our own hearts can answer. Thank you for listening to this commentary podcast. You can find footnotes supporting some of the statements in this podcast at our website, Stillwaters Ministry, www.visitstillwaters.com. You may also find more podcasts there as well.